This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier this week, a new national intelligence estimate concluded that Iran halted its nuclear weapons program in 2003. There's been enormous controversy over the implications of the finding and why U.S. intelligence agencies reached the opposite conclusion just 2 years ago. There is no dispute over the fact that Iran is rapidly developing the capacity to enrich uranium. They say the thousands of gas centrifuges at an enormous facility in Natanz in Iran will produce fuel for nuclear reactors to generate electricity. Critics point out those same machines can also be used to further enrich the uranium and make fuel for nuclear weapons. The story of how Iran's program got started is one of the subjects of a new book about A.Q. Khan, a Pakistani scientist who played a key role in the development of Pakistan's nuclear arsenal and then sold the technology to Iran, Libya, and to North Korea. The authors join us in just a moment. Later in the program, we'll talk about Mormonism. Presidential candidate Mitt Romney spoke earlier today about his religion and his politics. If you have questions about what Mormonism is or isn't, you can send emails to us now. The address is talk@npr.org. But first, A.Q. Khan, if you want to know more about who he is or about the policies that allowed him to proliferate, our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Douglas France and Catherine Collins join us here in Studio 3A. Their new book is The Nuclear Jihadist, the true story of the man who sold the world's most dangerous secrets and how we could have stopped him. And thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
And after reading your book, I have to say that the arguments about Iran's nuclear ambitions sound remarkably similar to earlier arguments about Pakistan and Iraq.
They sure do. I mean, it's not just Pakistan and Iraq, but it's almost every country that has developed nuclear weapons outside the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty has initially disguised that weapons program as a civilian operation to generate electricity. You certainly saw that with Pakistan before them. You saw it happen with India. Same thing with Israel. And if you go back a little further, it's the same thing with China and France before they came out with their nuclear weapons.
What do you make of the news that we're reading today that the NIE changed the assessment in part due to intercepted conversations of Iranian scientists complaining that they were being forced to stop designing nuclear warheads? Does that make sense to you, Catherine?
I'll pass that one on to Doug.
Okay. Well, you know, I think in a way it makes sense, but the problem has been, and I think the reason we can go from 2005 to saying there's a nuclear program to 2007 saying that they've halted their nuclear program is because Iran remains a very opaque place for the United States and for Israel also, both of which spy pretty heavily on Iran or try to. But it's very difficult to get solid intelligence out of there. We should remember that in the summer of 2002, Iran's clandestine nuclear program was first revealed not by a government, but by an Iranian resistance organization based in Paris, but they had a press conference here in the United States. And it was, therefore, you know, Iranian exiles and Iranians inside Iran who provided that information. And so I think that demonstrates, Neil, how difficult it is for the Americans and others to know what's going inside there. But as far as the specific news of the day and the story you're referring to, I think, from the New York Times, I mean, it's fascinating. But you do have to wonder, you know, whether that's real information or disinformation. I think there still remained, looking at the NIE, as Catherine and I have done this week, and at the other news reports, there are still a lot of questions about how much the U.S. government knows.
Well, let's get to questions about how that program got started. And the man responsible for it in many ways, A.Q. Khan, he lived in India as a boy. This was before the partition, and witnessed the violence of that horrible conflict that followed after Pakistan separated from India. And that, you write, Catherine, helped shape his whole attitude towards life.
It sure did. He was born in India, and throughout his lifetime he repeated the same story over and over again about his fellow Muslims being forced to flee the soon-to-be-divided British India. And he remained convinced, I think, all his life that India was determined to bring an end to his new nation, Pakistan. And he would tell the same story, and the story was about himself hopping on a train to go to Pakistan for the first time, and with people crammed into these cars, and the police would go from one family to another family taking things. And Khan was traveling on his own as a teenager. And
11 years old or something like that? Oh, a little older than that, 14.
A little older than that. And he had just finished school, and he had a graduation present, a gold pen in his pocket. And one of the policemen noticed this shiny thing and grabbed it from him. And it might strike you as a very, you know, simple theft, not a big deal in the face of all the turmoil, and certainly many people suffered much more. But he referred to this story throughout his life to demonstrate his never-ending distrust and hatred for the Indians.
And finally, after having achieved success and living in one of the grandest houses in Islamabad, has, you describe, a painting that he has on his wall of that scene of the fire on the rising from the railroad cars as he's walking towards Lahore and Pakistan.
Yes, yeah. But I had to rely on someone else's account for that. I would not have been permitted into his home or to talk to Dr. Khan in person.
He is a man, though, who was not, at least initially as you describe him, a fervent Muslim. He spent a lot of time in Europe, got educated, a lot of his scientific education in Europe, and in fact, the first hold that you describe in the Western system of trying to prevent proliferation was in the Netherlands, where he went to work for a Dutch company where he shouldn't have even had his job if they'd done their background check correctly.
Well, exactly. Khan went to Europe after doing his first bit of education in Pakistan. Like many Pakistani students, there just were not the educational or job opportunities. So he went to Europe, got his advanced degrees, and took a job at a lab in the Netherlands called FDO, where they were developing the most advanced centrifuges at the time. It was a consortium with the British, the Germans, and the Dutch cooperating together. And the work was so feverish and the speed was so fierce that they didn't do the proper security checks for Dr. Khan. And he was allowed to work in this lab and without getting the appropriate clearances. And later, in fact, he was asked to translate the most sensitive documents they had for the latest designs for the ultracentrifuges. And he was asked to translate them from German to Dutch, all 16 volumes. And he was allowed in the most secure facility at FDO in order to do that. And he would sometimes take them home in his briefcase, saying he needed some help from his wife to do it, or that a secretary outside the brain box would have to type them later.
And evidently was making copies for himself.
Exactly.
And you described, though, a turning point in his life of the last, fortunately, war between Pakistan and India, where he saw Pakistani soldiers being humiliated. And at that moment, he decided he needed to make his step to affect the fate of his nation.
Yes, he was determined to go home and make a difference at some point in his future. Yes.
And at that point, he gets in touch with the then Prime Minister of Pakistan, offers his services. They are rebuffed at first, but finally succeeds and eventually walks out of that facility in the Netherlands with huge volumes of information, not just about uranium enrichment, but huge volumes of information about who to contact for all kinds of parts to build a nuclear power, a nuclear enrichment cycle from scratch.
Exactly. But he not only had the plans, just as important was the fact that he took with him a list of suppliers. Pakistan could not possibly manufacture all the elements needed for an enrichment program, and they didn't have all the raw materials available, so they had to shop on the open market for these things. And many of these products were restricted or dual-use items and raised a lot of suspicion. So he went out with a list of all the places to go to get them.
And you've written, Douglas, that in fact, Pakistan's bomb isn't really Pakistan's. It's an American bomb. It's a Russian bomb. It's a Dutch bomb. A German, all kinds of people are responsible for this.
Yeah, before globalization was a known term, I think, A.Q. Khan built the first global nuclear weapon. He relied on equipment and technology and expertise that came from a whole host of countries, including the United States and Canada. And that raised, you know, sort of an interesting question about where the United States could have stopped or at very least delayed Pakistan's nuclear weapon.
And this, you write, is not an intelligence failure, but a policy failure. Describe what you mean
by that. Absolutely. You're exactly right. I mean, the intelligence the CIA and other American intelligence agencies were well aware of what A.Q. Khan was doing as early as 1975, just before he left the job in Amsterdam that Catherine was talking about. They became suspicious that he was in fact stealing information and that he was some kind of a Pakistani spy. By that time, the world knew that Pakistan had embarked on a nuclear weapons program, and so it had brought some additional suspicion on him. And the Dutch were concerned enough that they wanted to arrest him, and the security service argued for arresting him. And this was in the fall of 1975, and the economics ministry didn't want to arrest Khan because they didn't want the embarrassment of admitting that they had a spy inside their most sensitive high-tech facilities. And so the Secret Service of Holland, of the Netherlands, went to the CIA. They asked the CIA for some support, expecting that they would be able to tip the balance. In fact, the CIA suggested that Khan not be arrested, that he be allowed to go about his business at that point.
So they could find out more about what he was doing.
Exactly. They wanted to keep watching him and find out what he was doing. It turns out to be what Bob Einhorn, a former administration official in the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, told us was the first monumental error.
Not the last. We're going to talk at greater length in just a minute about how this nuclear technology spread not just to Pakistan and fueled their nuclear weapons program, but then moved around the world. But beginning with Pakistan, Pakistan's motive for this is simple and clearly understandable. Their neighbor and great rival, India, developed nuclear weapons too, and they feel that they needed to. Of course, India thought they were protecting themselves against China, but Pakistan thought the nuclear weapons were aimed at them.
Yes, I think that's a common thread that runs through the spread of nuclear weapons around the world. There are fears. The Russians develop a nuclear weapon to counter the United States. Britain, France, and China have to be part of that club. If you look at Israel, surrounded by adversaries, they were determined to develop a nuclear weapon. North Korea developed a nuclear weapon under threat of nuclear attack by the United States dating to the Korean War. And so you can understand, I think, what motivated Pakistan, and you can also then understand what motivated Iran, I think.
We're talking with Douglas France and Catherine Collins. Their new book is The Nuclear Jihadist, the true story of the man who sold the world's most dangerous secrets and how we could have stopped them. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This week, of course, it's Iran's nuclear ambitions that are in the news, but A.Q. Khan also helped spread nuclear weapons technology to Libya, to North Korea, and to Pakistan, his home country. His story makes up the new book, Nuclear Jihadist, the true story of the man who sold the world's most dangerous secrets and how we could have stopped him. You can read about A.Q. Khan's first days on the job at a physics research laboratory in Amsterdam at our website at npr.org/talk. The authors of the book are with us today, Douglas France and Catherine Collins. If you want to know more about who A.Q. Khan is or about the policies that allowed him to proliferate, our phone number is 800-989-8255, and our email address is talk@npr.org. And here's an email from Adam in Tampa. I've heard on other NPR programs it's very likely A.Q. Khan was made a scapegoat by the Pakistani government, that checks and balances in the Pakistani nuclear program made it impossible, that the nuclear proliferation was based largely on one man. Could your panelists please comment on this? Douglas?
Sure. It's a good question, Adam. I don't think that A.Q. Khan has been made a scapegoat. On the other hand, he could not have done all this on his own. The checks and balances issue, let me talk about that. There are very few checks and balances in Pakistan. And certainly in the 70s and the 80s, A.Q. Khan operated with a completely free hand. He went to Zulfikar Ali Bhutto when he was prime minister, when he came back and said, in order for me to carry out this program and to do it in the high speed, with the sort of miraculous speed that Bhutto demanded. He needed a free hand. He needed unlimited access to cash to go on to the black market to buy the technology he needed. He didn't want auditors overseeing him and looking at his books and asking questions about his transactions. And so over time, he was able to exploit that freedom and make himself a very wealthy man, and also divert some of the technology and equipment and expertise to Iran, North Korea, and Libya. You know, that said, he didn't do this on his own. The questioner is exactly right. I mean, there was at the very least several instances in which Pakistani military and political leaders turned a blind eye. We write about one episode of the book at the end of 1993 when AQ Khan went to Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, the daughter of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, and asked her to help him by acquiring plans to build a missile that would carry a nuclear warhead. He asked her to go to North Korea and get those plans from the North Koreans on his behalf, and she did that. You know, so certainly the leaders knew what he was up to in Pakistan, and they also encouraged some of the sales to Iran in 1980, which began in 1987.
There's one little story, a funny little story, that indicates the level at which he was receiving support. The well-known Pakistani security agency, the ISI, did something to take care of and protect Khan, and certainly illustrates how much they knew about him. There was a wonderful book written in the early 80s called The Islamic Bomb, and I believe it was hard to find in Pakistan. I was speaking with a nuclear scientist there just a couple years ago, and he had a copy of the book on his desk. And I said, how did you happen to get a copy of this book? This was in Islamabad.
It was banned in Pakistan. Yeah.
I believe it was. And he said it was the strangest story. He had received it a few years before, and it was delivered by a man on a motorcycle wearing a helmet. He couldn't see his face, and he was handed this book in a brown paper package. And he went inside, opened it up, and discovered it was the Islamic bomb. And as he read it, he noticed it seemed a little strange. And he heard later that it had been distributed across Pakistan to people in positions of power. And when I looked at it, I realized it wasn't my copy of the Islamic bomb. And I photocopied it, took it back to Istanbul, where we were living, and went through it line by line. And there were 100 changes in the text. And so the ISI later, someone, a former ISI official, told us this is one of their great successes, that they managed to republish this whole book. And
after rewriting it.
Yes, just the chapters that concern Pakistan and Khan, and put a whole different light on this scientist.
Let's see if we can get some callers on the line. And let's go to Stuart. Stuart with us from Omaha.
Hi there. Another book, Deception, makes, I think, a crucial point, and that is that the Pentagon and the State Department deliberately lied to Congress on a number of occasions. And so it leads me to just believe that when you cover up intelligence to the larger American public, you do so at great peril, because the greater public, you know, would never have accepted this.
That forms quite a bit of the heart of the book, how Congress was lied to. And indeed, there's a story about one particular man, Rich Barlow, whose career was destroyed by the fact that he told the truth.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Rich is a central and heroic figure in our book, as well as in Deception, I suspect, given Rich's penchant for talking. But, you know, Rich worked for the CIA, and when he found the CIA providing false information to the Congress of the United States about Pakistan's nuclear program, he spoke up within the CIA, and he was punished there. He was banned, and he ultimately lost his job. He finally got another job in the office of the Secretary of Defense at the Pentagon. The Secretary of Defense at that time was a man named Dick Cheney. And then again, the United States didn't want the truth to come out about Pakistan's nuclear program, about its procurement efforts, because we were still allies with Pakistan, and because at that time the Soviets were being driven out of Afghanistan with help from money and arms funneled into the Afghan resistance by the United States through Pakistan. Now, there was a conscious decision made at the end of 1979, a few days after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, where Zbigniew Brzezinski was the national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, and he told him, you know, we have an opportunity here to defeat the Soviets with the help of Pakistan, but we have to turn a blind eye toward Pakistan's nuclear program. And that was the position that the Carter administration took. It was the position adopted by the Reagan administration and by the first Bush administration. They sent a packet of lies up to Congress for more than 10 years so that we could keep that alliance with Pakistan alive.
It was a bipartisan effort, but the point is that when you go by, you know, the enemy of your enemy is your friend, you ultimately lose.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. Just to follow up on that point, you say this was you describe it a couple of times in your book as a short-sighted strategic goal to try to defeat the Soviets in Afghanistan, yet played a key part in winning the Cold War. Clearly, that's not a short-term strategic goal. These are different. It's not saying either one justifies lying to Congress and lying to the American people, but nevertheless, these are counterbalancing aims, and maybe they are mutually exclusive.
Yeah. I'm not sure, Neil, that they are in fact mutually exclusive. I'm not sure how much. I mean, certainly the defeat in Afghanistan played a role in bringing down the Soviet Union. But we certainly know now from the archives that have been opened in Moscow now that their economy was coming down, that Gorbachev was looking for another way to shut down the Cold War, basically. You know, so but even if I give you that, you know, that it played a role there, it's not worth it when you take an issue as important as nuclear proliferation and put it on the back burner. I mean, I think the Bush administration has done exactly the same thing with the war on terrorism, as they call it. They've turned a blind eye toward a lot of bad things going on in Pakistan. They allowed AQ Khan to continue operating after 2001 and 2002 because they didn't want to push Musharraf to take harder action against him. And, you know, it may not seem quite as short-sighted now as it would after there's a nuclear attack on an American city or a Western European city that is traceable to fissile material or a nuclear device that came from Pakistan or from one of the countries that was assisted by AQ Khan.
Email question from Hal in Edmond, Oklahoma. Where did Khan learn bomb design? I haven't read anything that indicates Pakistan went through an entire Manhattan Project process to acquire a working bomb design. In other words, we're talking about how he got the fuel, the material, the highly enriched uranium for the bomb. Designing a weapon, that's another trick entirely.
Well, they had a divided duties in Pakistan. Khan's job was to provide the fissile material, the enriched uranium to fuel the bomb. The Pakistan Atomic Energy Commission, the PAEC, was charged with developing the actual bomb device, the nuclear device that used this fissile material at its core. And I think, in fact, it's not so hard now to build the bomb. And that's why when you look at this last national intelligence estimate on Iran, you don't want to relax your guard completely, because the hardest step in developing a nuclear weapon is producing the fissile material. Building a bomb is a pretty easy part, and our best example of that is that the Manhattan Project, in fact, never tested their bomb design before they dropped it down in the southern New Mexico desert and then went on to drop it on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They just weren't concerned, because the technology of actually building the bomb, while sophisticated, is not the hardest part of the process to master. It's enriching the uranium or else producing the plutonium. You can build a nuclear bomb with either one of those materials.
And let me return to the proliferation just for a moment. And one of the things that you write, again, there are two versions. One, that Khan was a greedy man who sold these plans and technology to enrich himself. The other, that this was Pakistani policy. One of the things you write is that the money for developing the bomb in the first place, much of it came from Libya in suitcases with hundreds of millions of dollars delivered. Libya was one of the countries that got materials from AQ Khan. You write that North Korea had something that Pakistan wanted very much, missiles to deliver their nuclear weapons onto India if necessary. That explains a little trade here, a little nuclear technology in exchange for some missiles from North Korea. And there's the case of Iran and something that General Zia called the strategic regional consensus, an idea of an alliance between Pakistan, Iran, Turkey, all of these Central Asian countries that would stand up to India, at least in his point of view, and that might explain some materials going to Iran. And then there is the question of some missing material, 75 to 80%, by estimates of some sources in the IAEA, say 75 to 80% of Khan's network has been uncovered. There's some stuff still missing. Was there a fourth customer. Who was it, and was it Saudi Arabia?
Well, we don't know yet who the fourth customer or who the other customers could have been. Could have been five, I mean, an extra two customers. The problem is, I think, that Khan has never been debriefed. He's never been questioned by American, European, or international investigators. And it's Khan who has the answers to these questions. And he's really, I think, the only person who can tell us where he took this technology and with whom he shared the plans.
And he is under house arrest today?
He's been under house arrest since 2004 when he gave a public confession in English on television and very quickly afterwards was pardoned by Musharraf. But he has not been questioned, and I don't believe the American officials have pressured Pakistan to have access to him. And the reasons are obvious, perhaps, that Musharraf's own hold on power is quite tenuous, and Americans, of course, would worry about what would happen to him if they forced him to challenge a man who continues to be an enormously popular figure in Pakistan. Dr. Khan is very popular remains popular on the streets today. But also, maybe he hasn't been questioned or the Pakistanis haven't provided access to him because he could implicate other high-ranking officials in the government, in the ISI, in the military. And also, his network could be continuing to supply Pakistan's program.
We're talking with Catherine Collins and Douglas France about their new book, The Nuclear Jihadist. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's another caller. This is Travis. Travis with us from South Bend in Indiana.
Yep, that's right.
Go ahead, please.
I had question. Who was anybody in the U.S. ever held accountable for allowing these secrets to be kept away from the public government?
That's a great question. I'm glad to get it from a fellow Hoosier.
Yeah, thank you.
No, the only person ever held accountable was Rich Barlow, who lost two jobs over his efforts to cry out and is still fighting and struggling to get the government pension that he was owed. You know, and he's the ultimate victim here, and nobody else has been accountable. Nobody lost their job. Nobody lost an election because of these lies that were told to Congress over and over about what the Pakistanis were up to. So, you know, it's a good question, and a short answer is no, just Rich.
Wow, that is amazing. Well, thank you very much.
And thanks for the call. And let's see if we can go to Scott. And Scott with us from Jackson in Michigan.
Hi, glad to be here. I just had to say there's not going to be any clarity in this discussion until we stop believing our own double talk about nuclear power. I have to go back to the old Atomic Energy Commission slogan, Atoms for Peace. Well, Atoms for Peace equals the big lie. Environmentally and economically, nuclear power has never been good for anything except to build bombs. That it's even being perpetuated now by the selling of nuclear power as an alternative energy source to stop global warming, in spite of the fact that a nuclear power plant is exothermic. It generates tons of heat into the biosphere that never would have been there otherwise. And I think the only good news about this is that with North Korea, the agreement we reached with North Korea involves them not only abandoning their weapons program, but shutting down their reactor. And I think we should stop lying to the Iranians and saying that our nuclear power program has ever been good for anything but building weapons. It's an environmental and economic boondoggle. And again, yes, you know, Atoms for Peace was always the big lie. And that's why we trained thousands of scientists at our universities and sent them to India and Pakistan so they could set up their own nuclear power programs. And all I can say is if Iran has nuclear reactors for power generation, they'll get the bomb eventually.
Catherine?
I think this gentleman knows a lot more about nuclear energy than I do, but you're raising a whole different can of worms. But as long as we're talking about inequity and things not being equal, for years, it's been since the beginning, or since almost the beginning, there have been five nuclear powers and then the four undeclared states. And the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty has been very helpful since 1970 when it came into effect at controlling this as well as it could be. But just last year, I think, Mohammed al-Baradei, the director of the IAEA, warned us that there are 30 additional states that could overnight become nuclear states. with a flip of the switch, and you might not worry if Canada were to go nuclear, but most countries, when they make the decision to cross that line, will affect all the other countries, all their other neighbors. And this is a very serious issue, that nuclear weapons have become ubiquitous. It's as if the nuclear age has come out of its infancy and into its maturity, and it's turning into a potential monster.
Yet in your conclusion, you say, look, there are the United States and Russia, for that matter, aren't doing enough to reduce their nuclear stockpiles. But one person does say in your book, unless we eliminate nuclear power, we're not going to eliminate nuclear weapons.
Yes, that's right. And that's Leonard Weiss, who was a prominent Senate staffer and is a nuclear expert. He argues as something I think your caller would agree with and something that we don't disagree with, that's for sure, is that you won't eliminate this risk until you eliminate nuclear power.
That's not going to happen anytime soon, is it?
I don't think so, not in these current circumstances.
Well, thank you both very much for coming in. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Speaking with Douglas France and Catherine Collins. Their book, The Nuclear Jihadist, The True Story of the Man Who Sold the World's Most Dangerous Secrets and How We Could Have Stopped Them. Coming up, Mitt Romney, the Republican presidential hopeful, spoke earlier today about faith and politics, and many of you sent us questions about his Mormon faith. We'll try to get you some answers. If you have questions about what Mormonism is or isn't, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.